All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck Knicks? What the fuckadelics? What the fuck Tuckians? What the fuckocrats? What the fucklickins? What's happening? How are you? Is everybody okay? Is there a dire tone to my voice right now? Can you hear it? Are you okay? Talk to me. Can you hear me? Can you see these? Look, how many am I holding up? Hey, can you smell this? What, can you feel me? Can you feel this? Can you feel that? Are you okay? Snap out of it. Snap out of it. Oh, I should read you that email. Yeah, let me get you this email. Subject line, snap out of it. Mark, craziest damn thing ever. I'm not someone who talks to myself out loud ever, but I was just walking along, walking my dog, feeling miserable about everything, and I heard you say at the beginning of the Dan Levy episode, how are you doing? You doing all right? And I said out loud, and I remind you, I am not someone who speaks out loud to himself. Not good, Mark. Not good at all. And you said, and I have no idea whether you were quoting the movie Moonstruck or not, but you said it loudly and in a somewhat share-like voice, snap out of it. And I did. I laughed heartily. Anyone watching me would think I'm a truly crazy person. Thank you and have an amazing day. I will now continue my walk and continue with the episode, but I simply had to share this in the first few moments after it happened. Yours in serendipity, Nick. You're welcome, Nick. I hope you're still snapped out of it. Huh? It's easy to fall back into it. It's hard to stay snapped out of it. Am I right? God damn. Oh, this is another email. I think this is important. By the way, my guest today is film director, usually a documentarian, but this is a feature film. Liz Garbus is here. Her film Lost Girls. That's it. It's streaming on Netflix. She's also directed a lot of documentaries, but she's the person I talked to today. Also, Andy Kindler. I'm not saying the shorty is back, but the shorty might pop up every once in a while now that we're doing interviews in a different way. Also, I want to give you a heads up about the cat mugs, the Brian Jones mugs. Right now, I can't give the cat mugs to any guests because not many guests are joining me here in the garage. But you can get your own ceramic cat mug right now and act like you've been here to the garage. These are handmade by Brian Jones, my guy. My Potter guy, my Potter pal, and he's donating a percentage of the sales to the Connecticut Food Bank. Go to brianrjones.com/shop, starting at noon Eastern today. Get a mug. Here's another email. Please do the USPS a solid. And this is from a postal guy. Mark, I deliver mail, and I've always been happy to greet my customers and hand them their mail when they come out to see me. However, due to the current situation, I'm wondering if you can help provide a public service announcement, which is, please let your mail carrier put the mail in the damn box. We realize that you miss physical and personal interaction, but we deliver to hundreds of houses, businesses, and apartments each day. Please help us keep all of our customers safe by not coming out of your house and taking the mail from our hands. I deliver in Texas, where not everybody is taking this pandemic seriously. If you can help get the word out, maybe I won't have to become a human billboard and wear a sign telling people to keep 6 feet away from me. Thanks a lot, and I'm glad I got to see you on your tour stop in Dallas last year before the world comes to an end. Stay safe, Joran. All right, you heard the guy. All right? Say hi to your mail carriers from a distance, but let them put the mail in the box. So, folks, as a general warning in a general way, and I don't even know what it means, but understand that angry, desperate people are vulnerable to being told what to do with that anger, and it might not be good. And a few things on the list of things that angry, vulnerable, desperate people aren't quite capable of is perhaps empathy, thinking of others, and tolerance. Just a general heads up, and I'm not talking about any type of person. I'm just talking about if there's a way that you can reach out, provide a little something, a little support to people who are desperate, angry, and vulnerable, that would be a good thing. That'd be a mitzvah. It would help you and them. I don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know if it's with money, with a hello, anything. because it's going to get bad. And more people are going to get sick. And that's what's really happening. Look, and I know there's a struggle between our cognitive selves and this dissonance. You know, there's a whole other narrative being pummeled into our brains, and we want it to be true, but I don't believe it's true yet. We're not good. It might not ever be as good as it was, but one thing I can tell you for sure is we are not good. And there's some movement on the side of the people in control of some people's minds saying, like, it's all right. We're going to take a hit, but if it's lucky, it won't be you. Now get back to it. But we're not good. So enjoy some movies. Try to stay in the present. We'll ride this out. You all right? Snap out of it. Also, that's another thing that's interesting about this time is that nothing is going to be the same if and when we get out of this. So even though we're compromised, there is a sort of intimacy to what's happening in most people's lives. You know, lock in, get deep, feel it, understand who you are to yourself and to the people that are important to you. Get the love, man. Tap into the love. So here's what I've been doing. Movies. Here's the movies I've been watching. I watched Lost Girls. My guest today directed it. I watched In a Lonely Place. It's an old Nick Ray film. With Gloria Graham and Humphrey Bogart, tremendous. Lynn dragged me into the 1970s Private Eye movie hole with Night Moves, starring Gene Hackman, and Drowning Pool, starring Paul Newman. Neither one of those films had I heard of or seen. Both had their high points, those leading men specifically, great. Melanie Griffith, oddly, in both of them as well, as a teenager almost, I believe. The Assistant I watched with that, is her name Julia Gardner from Ozark? Great actress. Really powerful little film. The Assistant, new film, takes place in an office of sort of a fictionalized Harvey Weinstein character. But it's all on Julia, and she's tremendous. I watched Tony Erdmann, which is a film I wanted to see in New York, a German film, which I could not see because it was always sold out back when it came out. Finally got to watch that. Long film, weird film, great film. Tony Erdmann. Watched Ace in the Hole for the upteenth time with Kirk Douglas. Billy Wilder film. Tremendous. Dark. Interesting. Always relevant. Ace in the Hole. And Ride with the Devil, a very odd, interesting approach to a Civil War movie directed by Ang Lee. With Jeffrey Wright and Skeet Ulrich and Tobey Maguire and Jewel. Never heard of it. Lynn turned me on to that movie too. It got buried by the studio because they didn't know how to sell it because it was about basically Confederate soldiers, one of whom was black. Interesting. And that person was Jeffrey Wright, who I talked to, and I wanted to watch it before I talked to him. So that's what's going on there. All those movies I can recommend. Right now, I want to bring on a guest that I've had on many times before. I love the man. His debut comedy album, Hence the Humor, comes out tomorrow, May 8th. You can pre-order it today from aspecialthing.com or get it wherever you get your albums. It's about 40 years in the making, this record. And I had to get Andy on to ask him, what's the backstory, Andy? But this is me talking to the always funny I just love the guy, Andy Kindler.
Well, I'll start recording now just in case we say anything great.
Yeah, we already got through half of it.
Yeah, that's right. But don't keep it fresh. Keep it fresh.
Okay. How's it going over there? Do you have enough coffee?
I do have coffee. I know we didn't. I certainly hope our differences with dark roast and light roast won't prevent us from joining together.
I really don't know if that's going to happen. Are you drinking a dark roast?
No, I'm drinking a light roast. And I know that you enjoy PG tips.
I do. But listen, I have switched to light roast, my friend. I think probably because of something you told me. I drink almost exclusively light roasts now. Right now, I happen to be drinking a dark roast because sometimes I crave the flavor of a dark roast, but I understand the nuances of the different types of flavors that happen in a light roast. I understand them.
Wow, this is a different you. It used to be you'd be like, do what you, just give me something with your stupid, that you'd knock me across the room somehow. Now, so, of course, some things that are called dark roast coffee, like Intelligentsia, they make a dark roast, but it's not really a dark roast. They want to.
What does that mean?
It means it's just their version of a dark roast, but they don't make any roast that's like a real dark roast.
All right, no, like a dark roast is when the beans are burnt and oily.
Yes, used to be called in the old days Italian roast.
Right, right, or sometimes just like you fucked that batch up. That's burnt.
I know that feeling. I used to have I'm so old, I used to have a percolator.
Percolator.
Huh?
I think those might come back. Why don't you bring back the percolator?
Well, my mom also had something in her basement, which I don't want to talk about. She had a Chemex, an old Chemex.
Oh, yeah. That's the big glass thing, the glass bowl on top of the glass ball?
No. That's a siphon. It's the glass cone.
A siphon.
It's the glass cone.
Yeah, sure. Those are nice.
Did I ever tell you the time I was in I smoked pot in the basement of my house, and my father was in the kitchen, and I came back upstairs, and I swore he had smelled it, but he didn't. But this is what he said to me. I get back up there, and he goes, Andy, do you think I'm an idiot? And I was like, oh, my God. No, you're very intelligent. Very intelligent man. Very, very bright. He goes, because a lot of people would think I'm an idiot married to your mother all these years. Like that, he had no idea that I was smoking. He thought, and so it was one of those things. He was just thinking about the misery of his life.
Yes, and I, as we talked about before, I'm sorry to hear about your mother and your sister.
I know. I can't believe. I say it like you, I just found out. I know. This. I mean, I haven't checked. I haven't checked with people.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
I know.
I thought you knew. You didn't know. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I saw it on Facebook.
I want to let people know that I texted Mark 45 times. Maybe we shouldn't bring it up. Don't bring it up. You can bring it up. Why am I telling you? You are Mr. Honesty. I mean, you know what I'm saying. You're Mr.
Well, we didn't have that much time, and I know you were talking about it. Was there sickness? What happened?
My parents, my dad died in 2015. And then, and I used to have this joke where at my father's funeral, my mother turned to me and she said, Andy, I have to, but you?
Yeah.
Which is based on a very, very old joke. So that was very, very funny until the recent tragedy. And then I just lost my mama, who was 90 with Parkinson's, and then I lost, my sister was a surprise. She was like 69 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And she'd been sick for many, many years, and nothing to do with the coronavirus. So I don't want anybody people thinking.
Your mother lived till she was 90, huh?
90.
That's good.
And she was also a Quaker. She converted from Judaism to Quakerism, a very spiritual religion.
Huh.
What's it called when you watch yourself on the screen? What is that? Is that called? I have my new expression, Lego my ego.
Yeah. So tell me about this.
I can't let go of it.
Tell me about this this record that's been, 40 years in the making. I think that's probably it better be good.
Well, you know, all of my new thing now is like everything I make, podcasts, everything's on vinyl. Yeah. I don't make anything else but vinyl.
Are you burning this into vinyl right now? Is this going through a mastering process on an analog machine?
I'm using an Edison spool for this one, but yes, you're correct. I'm burning a wax disc.
Nice. And then you'll press it into the metal disc, which then will mold the vinyl.
That's right. No, this is something that it took me 7 years. I recorded it in 2013, Mark, and I have terrible OCD as opposed to the attractive kind.
Yeah.
It means I'm not able to finish projects, but I didn't know until I was 50. I came to you when I was 50 and on Adderall and telling you about that change, but then I got on Prozac and then on OCD realized I can never finish things. I can't let them go. I can't complete them.
But let me ask you a question. Does that have anything to do with the amount of weed?
I think ultimately I'm in therapy. As you know, I'm in therapy. And every time I go into therapy, I expect you to go, all right, look, I've overlooked it for the last couple of years, but this weed thing, Well, what's your end game with this? What's your end game? You have OCD and ADD, so you think, oh, maybe if I add like a little more paranoia to that and forgetting. So I think you're right on this one. I don't think it's quite like a 12-step thing, but I think the pot's in, it's nowheresville.
This was always my issue with pot, is that a lot goes on in your head and it doesn't manifest into reality.
That's true. Remember that bit that Rich Scheidner used to do? What? He would go, I'd smoke pot to think about what I wanted to do. Then I would snort coke to get excited about what I was going to do. And then I would drink to forget about what I was supposed to do. And then he's used to that bit about how you do a cocaine, you'd be with people that you never would hang out with. Oh, you kill people for a living? Oh, no, this, you have to do what you got to do. Got to do what you got to do. And then an hour later, I don't know if there is a gun, but if there is a gun, I think it could be me.
I never heard that take on it. Oh, you kill people for a living? Hey, you got to do what you got to do.
Oh, you keep them at school. Oh, you got to do what you got to do.
You were never that guy. You're never a coke guy, right?
Luckily I was unsuccessful during the 80s and not able to afford more. No, I could see it would have been a problem. There were nights where I had underneath the shower and I thought my heart was going to explode. Yeah. No, I think I really did dodge a bullet because after a while I didn't like the feeling. But
now how are the George Bush jokes holding up on the record?
I think you'll be very happy about this. I included future jokes because I knew it would take me a long time to release it. So I have jokes like, these are jokes for the future. That's a nice coat, sir. Where'd you get that? With Bitcoin. So I have a few of those jokes. Yeah. And I refer to President Boehner. I got that wrong.
Yeah, that was way wrong.
President Boehner.
That couldn't have been more wrong.
But otherwise, it's actually, sadly to say, for me thinking I'm prolific, it's pretty evergreen. It all makes sense.
Oh, it worked out? That's good.
Yeah, there's none of me doing a four-hour bit about the Earl. What was that thing about my life according to Earl? What was the thing that
Oh, yeah. Earl? Yeah, the thing. I remember. It's a whole TV show. He had to apologize for things or something? I don't remember.
Yeah, he had to apologize. And when I listen back to some of the old things I made fun of on the old speech, you can't even know what is that show where Whoopi was a cop and the other person was a priest?
I don't know anything anymore. I've become old. I'm not up to speed. I can't remember things from 3 days ago. I don't really give a fuck about it. I'm surprised that I don't remember. As this conversation I'm having with you goes by, it's disappearing seconds after.
Yeah.
So what's the hope for this record? That you sell how many? A million? What are you projecting?
No, this is it. I really don't have ambition anymore. Like I used to lie I didn't have when I was younger. I really have let go of sales. If I didn't let go, I'd just be disappointed. But I really am glad to get it out there. That's the thing. I feel like I can't believe how little of my own stuff is out there.
Yeah.
Except for like Comedy Central specials and things like that. So I think it's cool. And I love Mitch's album, Mitch Altogether.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of an audio album. So... You know, I'm not comparing myself to him, but I'm still alive, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, we remember Mitch. But I think that a lot of your stuff is out there in the hearts and memories of all of us, Andy.
I really hope something similar to this when Susan arranges the funeral thing that you say. And if you go long, I swear to God, if you go long... because don't forget, Jeff Ross is going after you to roast.
Yeah, you know I'll go long. Yeah. How's Susan doing?
We're doing good. You know, she's healthy. I'm healthy. We're not leaving. We're both OCD-ish, so we're not going to go into germy areas. I haven't been in the supermarket.
How are you eating then? How are you getting food?
We have cooked. Susan has made dinners. I've made dinners.
But you deliver the food? You have the food delivered?
Yeah. We wipe it down. That part, which I still don't like wiping.
Yeah.
Disinfecting food. Maybe I shouldn't take it out of the package.
Yeah, there you go.
Is this going to really add? Yeah. Come on,
the face
Mark.
Is going to work good on the podcast. So, have you talked to any of our friends?
No. And this is the thing. I don't know if you realize this, but I have gotten into the thing in life where I didn't call anybody, and I was afraid. And I would always go, "Oh, if I call someone, they're going to think I wanted to get together." Well, what's your excuse now, Andy? They can get together. Yeah. So I really hope that I will be contacting people. And I am starting to do it. That's the other side of having like an addiction to social networking.
Yeah.
You don't keep in touch with friends. That part of the quarantine I really kind of like.
What, not talking to people and not feeling pressured to see them at all?
I don't know what I'm saying. It's about the, without the obligation, then you really can reach out.
Oh, right, that's right.
I was having so many excuses. So many excuses were blocking me from, like, oh, they're going to want you to come right over. They don't want you to come over. They don't want to see you. So it's like the old days. I used to have fun conversations on the phone.
Right.
You remember those days.
Yeah, no, I've been doing that. I've been trying to do it, but I'm surprised at how few people actually reach out to me. But I'm always surprised about that.
Well, people assume that you're busy. You're in the category of people go, oh, he won't. What is he going
to? What do you mean? No one's got anything to do right now.
You see the excuse? My excuse. I should be reaching out to you, and I use the excuse. Oh, Mark's too busy. He doesn't want me to say hello. It's all on me.
Yeah. No, I
don't worry, my friend. I'm coming around.
I think people are very hung up on, you know, they're very caught up in their own little thing right now. And it's a scary time. So I reach out to a few friends. I've had a few long phone conversations with people. I guess, you know, like when I really think about it, I only have a few friends anyways. And I've talked to them. So that's good.
I miss the fest. And I really do. That's the one thing I do miss is I know if this goes on forever, I'll miss festivals and things like that. But a lot of the things about being around people, I don't miss. I don't miss going to a MAGA rally. And having hateful people spit on my neck.
Yeah, no. But, but it's fun to wear the hat. But you miss going to festivals?
Yeah, because that's all I've been the last few years. I go to Moon Tower. I go to the various Montreal and Toronto. And I really like it because you see your friends. You do get to see your friends there.
Yeah, everybody all at once. What's the album called, Andy?
Hence the Humor.
Oh. Do you thank anybody on the cover, on the back?
No thanking. This is another thing that got it. Will never be a physical copy. I was delaying it by going, I want a physical copy to sign after shows. I never want to see a person after a show for the rest of my life with the hand shaking and the sniveling and the sniffing. This is sanitized.
Right.
No physical copy. So no, I don't thank anybody.
And where do you get the thing?
Well, you can. It's coming out Friday, so it'll be available like on a special thing. They're the record label company. But then it's everywhere. Apple.
Okay.
Where do you like to go?
I'll go to the Apple.
Where do you get it?
Okay. Good.
Yes.
Good.
And you can pre-buy it there now.
I will make sure everybody knows that, Andy.
I love you very much, Mark. And I hope I haven't sounded too hungry.
No.
On this, but if you could also pitch my mugs.
Oh, what do you
I'm
got?
Selling these mugs. Like it's these mugs, but you put the name on afterwards. Look, you know the thing to say.
What kind of...
Hey, mug.
What kind of coffee are you drinking? What's the brand?
Today I'm drinking... I never had L.A. Is it L.A. Mill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff.
You know, I've never tried that before. It's excellent. A Brazilian.
Where'd you get that?
Had it shipped from there or wherever they ship in L.A.
That's pricey shit, man. But it's good, right?
That's good quarantine coffee.
I'm actually drinking my own brand right now, the WTF Dark. But I love you too, buddy. And make sure you
I love you, brother.
Let's send that recording to
right
Brendan
now.
Because it's gonna be better. This one was a disaster.
Okay, man. I love you, brother.
I love you too, pal.
Be good.
Yeah, you too. That was Andy Kindler. Again, his album, Hence the Humor, comes out tomorrow, May 8th. You can pre-order it today from aspecialthing.com or get it wherever you get your albums. Now, my guest, Liz Garbus, was excited to have her. I was always kind of mildly obsessed and interested in her father, the lawyer Martin Garbus, for the work famous constitutional lawyer. But I was mostly obsessed because he represented Lenny Bruce at some point. But he was also involved with Daniel Ellsberg. Very interesting backstory. But Liz Garbus, in her own right, has directed many great documentaries, one about her father and one about Nina Simone that was very popular. That one was called What Happened, Miss Simone. Lost Girls is a feature scripted film. It's her first with Amy Ryan, which is streaming on Netflix. And it's a powerful movie. And this is my conversation with Liz Garbus. How are you, Liz?
Good. Nice to meet you. I'm a fan.
Well, that's nice. I'm a fan of yours as well. We've never met, right?
No, but one of my closest friends and almost family members, because of a convoluted story is Jesse Peretz.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Who you've worked with on Glow, I think.
I've worked with him a few times.
And in any case, I don't, but it's really nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah. So wait, when did you go to Brown? Do you know my friend Sam Lipsight?
Yes.
Yeah.
Brown was Sam's girlfriend forever. And then he married, Kurtwin. But it was, I know Sam very well.
See, I met Sam when he was dating my ex-wife's best friend. I don't know what the timeline is, but I don't know that many people from Brown. But I just talked to somebody else who went to Brown. I talked to Laura Linney yesterday, and she went to Brown.
She did?
But she's older. I think she's older than you. So wait, where on the Cape are you hanging out?
I'm in Truro, and end of March, early April, I came up here with my family to escape the city for a little while, although I feel, tremendously guilty. And we will be returning, but it has been nice to have the fresh air.
Oh, you have to get out of New York.
Yeah, we left. My kids had a school break. I was like, what are they going to do? Whatever. It's champagne. It was champagne problems, right?
Yeah.
We had this option and we availed ourselves of it. Yeah.
But how do you, as a thinker, you're a person that's done a ton of documentaries, and documentaries have a specific point of view. I mean, what's your brain doing now in light of this thing, in terms of what you think is an important narrative? Are you thinking of any?
I think for me, my brain, I think probably like most people, can deal with the here and now,
Yeah.
This is as an individual, not as a filmmaker.
Right.
As an individual, I can deal with today. Today's good. Today right. is fine. I'm blessed. When I try to project out over time and I listen to, depressing podcasts with smart people, then I start to think, then I can reel a little bit, right? How does this work? I think about my children and their childhoods, and and then I also can see the silver lining of that. I can see the look, after World War One and the flu of 1918, we had the Roaring Twenties. After World War Two, we got healthcare, we got expanded, there are all kinds of positive things.
After World War II, we got Levittown.
We got Levittown. Well, and we did get some other things as well.
Yeah.
We had, increasing women in the workforce, we had better healthcare, and there were good things as well. So I do try to hold on to that. But as a creator, I'm very interested in protecting democracy. That seems to be one of the most important things.
Yeah.
I don't think I can add much to the discourse around the science of corona, but I think that, perhaps I can inspire people to want to hold dear this democracy and protect our rights. So in any case, those are the kinds of things I go to, because we now have a government that doesn't reflect the will of our people.
Of a majority of our people.
Yeah. And it's just going to continue going further down that rabbit hole. And I think, we are not a direct democracy, we're a representative democracy, and we deserve to have those representatives reflect our points of view.
Well, yeah, and I think it's interesting too. I watched a new film. Well, I think it is Lost Girls, the first film that you first, movie that you directed.
Oh God, you're going to have the documentary police coming after you.
Oh, am I?
Well, we think documentaries are movies. I mean, it depends what they are. If they're feature docs, and a lot of them go to theaters, we think they're movies.
Okay, let me rephrase it. I get it. No, I think they're movies too. I was just trying. I didn't know how to present that the genre of film that is. It's scripted, right? Not fictional.
Yeah.
Scripted.
Yeah, and you know what? I often get asked that question. I'm sort of the perfect target for this particular question, or one of them. And often people say to me, this was your first narrative film. And then I can get even more high and mighty about the fact that documentaries are narrative. Narrative means we're telling stories, and documentaries hopefully do that. Oh my God.
It's essential to documentaries to have a narrative.
Of course.
And also to end in a slightly ambiguous way.
Right, to leave you more confused and depressed. No. But yes, this is the first scripted film I have made. I worked on commercials, and in college I made films with but this was the first full-fledged scripted movie narrative film that I directed. Yes.
Well, that's interesting to me, because let's go back then, because I watched the last night, because I had not seen it. I watched the doc with you made with your father. Shouting Fire. Now, I had this weird thing about your father, because my first lawyer in show business was at your father's firm. And
Richard Pernett. Is that who it was?
No, Nancy Rose.
Oh, okay.
She was, I don't know what, you know, she wasn't a partner or anything, but she, you know, she started at Garbus. What was the name of this? Garbus? Who were the other names?
Frank Garbus. And then she left with Joe DiPello, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but like when she told me about your father, about Martin, I was like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. Why don't I like, but she's not that kind of lawyer. Your dad's not an entertainment lawyer. Your dad like was this huge First Amendment guy.
Correct.
But he's a mythic sort of lawyer who, you know, argued several times in front of the Supreme Court and, you know, defended Lenny Bruce. And like, so I didn't know a lot about him until I was starting to do research on you. And then I watched a movie. And he said a couple of things that were very interesting to me relative to your upbringing somehow.
Okay.
Well, there was just this weird question. Like, I'm watching it and I'm like, you know, I like learning about the Constitution. I like learning about the struggles around free speech and how everybody has to be defended if you want to make it really free and yada, yada. But then you asked him, you know, in relation to the Ellsberg situation, where, you know, he was hiding those documents at the house or copies of them, and that he could have been arrested and put in jail for whatever it was, treason or whatever, for years. And you said, did you take in mind that you have a family? You know, and he said, well, yeah, but I don't put those in the same, like, you know, that they're two separate things. But then what he said was like, you know, I realized that I could be put in jail. And it seemed like that his principles allowed him to say, I think that the act that was done would form some kind of bond, like that if he were put in jail, that in and of itself would create something lasting enough for you as his child to define who you were. That's how I read it.
No, you're absolutely right. And I had forgotten that comment. That film was from some years ago. And I think that's right. I mean, look, I think in the moment you do things because you're excited, you know, you've got these documents, it's a leak, it's the best leak going. It speaks to the crisis of the moment. You know, what if you had a document right now that said Trump is holding the, you know, the vaccine for Corona in his house until he can make a gajillion dollars in 2 years or whatever, right. You know, like whatever the scoop was that everybody wanted, you do it, right? Like you just do it. And then I think the true answer is when you do those things, as he was doing with the Pentagon Papers and Ellsberg, you just do them because that's who you are. And because you're maybe in some ways narcissistic, but in other ways altruistic and committed to something larger than yourself. Right.
But in retrospect, right. He was, you know, in retrospect, he was still able to frame it as he was willing to make that sacrifice because, you know, how that would be interpreted by humanity or society or his children would be, you know, large enough and principled enough to make up for the fact that he's in jail or that he didn't, you know, he didn't put his family first. Like, you know, he's putting his country first to a certain degree, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's right. Look, if my father had gone to prison for some amount of time for, you know, for fighting that the Pentagon Papers be published in the New York Times, I would honor that, you know, if I had lost him for years and years. I mean, I think he is right.
But I think you honored anyways. You just didn't need that drama. It's fortunate that we
didn't have to have that drama. Yeah.
That, you know, you didn't spend a life, you know, from that age. We were very young with a father in prison, with your mother wondering, yeah, how are you going to make ends meet? Is there any money left from the law practice? And, you know, maybe you wouldn't have gone to Brown. Who the fuck knows what would have happened?
Absolutely. You know, but then, you know, another one of my father's clients was Kathy Boudin, who was part of the Brinks robbery and part of the Weather Underground loosely.
Right.
And, you know, her son, Chesa Boudin, just became DA of Berkeley.
He
grew up, he lost his mother to prison. She was recently released. I mean, he lost her for 30 some years. You know, I'd have to fact check that. But, you know, so certainly in that case, seeing what Chesa Boudin became, it became him someone really, you know, committed to social justice. What his mother did, she regrets. I mean, she doesn't defend the fact that the Brinks robbery that she was involved with, you know, ended up killing Black police officers, working class people. And they were involved in the struggle for Black freedom. But in any case, you know, you can see examples where those kinds of sacrifices create wonderful offspring.
I guess then when did you start? Because it seems to me that, you know, your father's work and struggle and fight for I guess it's justice, but for the most part, constitutionality. When did that start? Did you consciously, were you aware that that had an impact on your thinking?
I can't say that there's a moment.
Yeah.
At some point I thought I wanted to go to law school and, you know, kind of do what he did. And then I realized that in some ways, and he actually told me that there were very few people who could kind of end up doing what he did. And especially as we were moving into the eight, you know, it was post-Reagan 90s. You know, he came up in the 60s, right? And it was like, it was a much smaller group of people doing that. And that perhaps it could be not the career that it would have been then.
Right. He had already he was dug in. He had a reputation. He was part of there was a small crew of them. And to enter that world as a newbie, you know, would have been difficult.
Yeah. And you look at, you know, of course, there are these, you know, criminal defense attorneys who do God's work trying to work on sentences of folks on death row, or, you know, I just did a film with the Innocence Project for Netflix. Like those guys, I mean, they are doing God's work. That is, as a human being living your life, working those cases, I mean, that is, those guys are like saints. I mean, like they're not well, extremely well paid given what the kind of options they would have with law degrees. And they lose all the frickin' time, you know, they just lose because the system is so stacked against them. So I guess at some point in the mid 90s, whenever I was kind of thinking about these things in a clear way, I decided that being a storyteller was my way through. And the first film I made was a film in the prisons called The Farm, Angola, USA.
And that was your first documentary?
Correct. Yeah.
How'd you start in the film business?
I was an intern at Miramax.
Oh yeah. Did you deal with the monster?
So for those who don't know, Miramax was the Harvey Weinstein's company before it became the Weinstein company. Very tangentially, I was an intern. I was like, they didn't even give me a chair to sit on. I was just like standing at a Xerox machine all day long. So I was so far from him. I do remember one day being called into his office and the door closing. And the only thing that I remember about that being in that office, maybe he met with interns, you know, once, maybe that was part of the company protocol. I don't know why I was in there.
Yeah.
But the thing that I remember that washed over me in the biggest way was it was so quiet. Mm. The room must have been soundproof. I mean,
really?
It was just so quiet in there. And then it was weird. I was uncomfortable. My dad was a lawyer and he knew my dad. So who knows what the dynamic in that room was, if Harvey was thinking about that at all, you know, knowing what he was getting away with.
Yeah.
Maybe it was irrelevant. Maybe I wasn't his type. But in any case, the thing that I remember was the quiet. But that was one of my first jobs. And well, it wasn't a job, it was an internship. And then I went to work for another filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, as his assistant, whose name is Jonathan Stack, who I ended up co-directing. I was his assistant. And then I brought an idea and I started working on it. And we ended up making the film The Farm together as co-directors.
Uh-huh.
So it was through him that I had my first chance. And I worked my way up.
And that was about the prison and Angola prison, right?
Yeah, that was about Angola prison in Louisiana. It was a former slave plantation turned prison farm, after Reconstruction. And it really focused on people serving life or death sentences. And it didn't focus on questions of innocence, it focused on, how do you make a life for yourself? How do you find meaning and hope and get up in the morning when you're living somewhere and you know you're going to be buried 10 feet from that spot in that prison cemetery where there's no chance of freedom. And what does that life look like and feel like? So it was not a film about judgment. It was a film about a world.
Do you see, like, I'm just kind of piecing this together as we talk, because I've made fun of the amount of documentaries available currently in the sense that, like, it seems that everybody thinks they can make one. That is the easiest way to sort of get involved is to make a documentary. You can do it with your phone. You know, people think that you don't have to really be good at anything. But the truth of the matter is you do honor to the type of documentary you do. You're a journalist, really, right?
Well, That's an interesting conversation. I don't think I'm a journalist precisely because of that word we both touched on at the beginning, which was narrative. Now, of course, there are journalists that are wonderful narrative storytellers. So I think of myself as a nonfiction storyteller. The reason I don't think of myself as a journalist is because I've spent a lot of time with journalists. I spent a lot of time with reporters, and they are very much beholden to, I'm going to get a comment from the other side. Well, if I don't have four people saying this, we can't put it in the story. Right. Documentary filmmakers, we don't have to do any of that. You know, we have a point of view on a world, and if it feels truthful to us and we feel like it is expressing something larger, doesn't matter if nobody else says that about it. You know, do we have to check our facts? Yes, but we as documentary filmmakers, we take the mushy, messy clay of life and sculpt it into something that has a shape, a beginning, middle, and end. And in doing so, you're leaving out a lot of that other clay. And right. I think that's a freedom that people who have the word journalist in their job title have to be very careful about.
Right, because you can, like, I get it. Because really the difference is it's about point of view.
Yes.
So like a journalist, if they're doing it correctly, should not have a point of view per se, a reporter.
Right. And maybe that's naive, right? Like we know they do have points of view. But I mean, I don't know if you would hear somebody, I'm not comparing myself to him at all, but is Truman Capote a journalist or a nonfiction novelist? You know, I mean, I don't know. It's like, what are those distinctions? What is Hunter Thompson? I mean, I don't know. I think that there are differences, and I think it's important for viewers to be aware of them.
I guess the distinction that I guess I'm trying to make, or that should be made, is that a reporter versus a journalist, there's a distinction there as well. Like a reporter True. Is a kind of journalist, right? But, yeah. You know, just like a nuts and bolts reporter, before they get a point of view, before they become a journalist of a certain specialty, their job is who, what, when, where, and why. And that's what they give you. So inherently, it means that there isn't, it doesn't have to be a sense of storytelling in a traditional sense, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And look, there are journalists who will say, here is life in a small town, and they'll depict it, right, without getting counter examples. I mean, that is similar to what we do.
Yeah. Right. I don't know why I asked it, because people say that to me, that I'm like, my responsibility is a journalist. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I don't really see myself as that way. Do you know what
right.
I mean? That and, you know, just because people glean things from what I talk about with people doesn't mean that I'm serving as a journalist or a reporter, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's just a weird thing that people backload onto me. But how do you so you're doing film work. You're not sure that you want to do documentaries when you're working for Weinstein, or you knew?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know. I mean, I was interested in feature films too. I thought I had 20 great ideas. You know, I mean, I had all of these.
Right. Aspects. You were going to write a script and whatever.
I was writing 20, you know, lots of them. Yeah.
So what was it? Was it a default to decide to do documentaries, or what compelled you to do the one you started with? And I mean, which was obviously great. Why the decision?
You know, I don't know if it's a decision so much. You know, it's like when you look at your life, are these all decisions, or there maybe some people have clear decision making moments.
Sure.
I feel like I'm walking on a path, and I'm choosing the best turns as I see them. But I went to work. I got a job. You know, I was an intern at Miramax, and I wasn't paid, and I was also doing other things. And then I got a job as an assistant to another filmmaker, and this was this guy Jonathan Stack, and he was making documentaries.
So you got kind of, you're like, wow, this is cool, basically.
Yes. And then I ended up connecting through a series of strange incidences with an inmate journalist named Wilbert Rideau, who wrote a magazine and a newspaper out of Angola prison in Louisiana.
Now, how do you find, like, what you guys are producing? You direct some, you produce some, but it seems like you have about 10 documentaries going on at all times.
Well, I don't, not as a director.
No,
not
right.
as a director.
Right.
Yeah.
But what is your production house like? How do you kind of divvy that stuff up?
Well, you know, as you say, there has been an explosion in the form of documentary, right? Like, I mean, it's just been happening, and projects will come to me that I cannot direct because I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
But I love them and I'm too selfish to just totally give them away. So then I try to find other filmmakers who I love and maybe have a little less experience or, you know, just are out, you know, and bring them in and help them get that project set up and going. I mean, I've been doing that throughout my entire career. Street Fight, which was the film about Cory Booker taking on Sharp James, the first kind of, you know, that was a first time filmmaker who brought some amazing material to me. And I was like, oh my God, how do we help? I want to help you make this film. So it's sort of an expansion of that.
Right.
And my husband is a producer and he, so we decided this would have been a terrible idea at the beginning of our marriage, but now some years later, we decided to put our heads together and, you know, broaden the mission of what we do by embracing a lot of other directors, you know, work in the company.
I guess that's like, I mean, I think that's very forward thinking and also is like a kind of nice adaptation of the technology definitely favors, you know, the medium that, you know, of documentary of making in the sense that like, if you got an idea or someone comes in with an idea to kind of wrangle, I would imagine to begin shooting is not like setting up a scripted feature.
Indeed.
But also, you know, the culture requires it. I think that it seems the reason why documentaries are popular is because people crave that type of conversation. I mean, I don't like, if you really think about it, and this is a curious question or observation, like the popularity of something like The Tiger King makes me nauseous. And, you know, I couldn't watch a half hour of it because it felt exploitive right from the beginning. And it felt that, you know, this was not going to be like some sort of educational or sort of provocative documentary. This was a celebration of broken people doing shitty things. Now, maybe I'm selling it short. I don't know. But that was my impulse, was that there's a morbid fascination that kind of coincides with the documentary boom. Is that possible?
Yeah, look, I think that, you know, what is documentary is Tiger King closer to reality television in some ways than it is to what we think of as documentary? Maybe. You know,
what's your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, aren't we here talking about some of my Netflix projects? Because I mean, I think, you know, it was a moment in our culture where everybody was staying home.
Yeah.
And, this was the most, you know, wild escape that captured the imagination of what is it? How many, maybe 60 million people. There were some numbers I saw thrown around yesterday, just an enormous segment of our population tuned into it. And it provided a detour. And like you said, a look at people who were struggling and flawed. Many of it, you know, in some ways they shed light on our current political system. You know, the way in which a person like that can run for, you know, the emptiness of choices. I mean, you didn't get that far, but Tiger King ends up running for, I think, governor or something like this. And, you know, actually gets some votes, you know, it's sort of incredible. So,
but not incredible.
I think, yeah, but not incredible. So I think it touched on something and I'm not sure I would call it documentary. I think one thing documentary filmmakers want to be able to do is go on to make another film. And I think that if your subjects are very hurt through the process of making one film, it could be hard to then get people to trust you moving forward. So that's an issue.
Well, let's talk about the choices you've made. What makes you make a choice? Like, you know, after doing, you know, The Farm, you know, what were some of the choices you made? Like, you know, how do you evolve this? Is this stuff that, like we said earlier, the documentary should be somewhat challenging and ambiguous at the end. So you're like, I don't know, is it or isn't it? Does that play into your choices?
I mean, I like, you know, narrative at the end of the day for me is key. I've never wanted to make a documentary because I want to attack this issue, right? Like that, right. I don't see as my role. I see my role as telling stories of incredible people that you don't get to meet in your life, maybe, or that I don't get to meet, and showing our shared humanity, even through people that you don't
shared
think
humanity.
You identify with. Yeah, I think that's it. Like, even if you don't think you identify with this inmate, or maybe, you know, and I guess that's where it goes back to Tiger King, because I don't know that you find the shared humanity there. I think that for me, it's like you look at the stories that I've made, whether it's, you know, Bobby Fischer, the chess champion, Nina Simone, you know, the high priestess of soul, or, you know, some folks in Angola, like we connect with each other in all these different ways.
What was the Wanda Jean doc?
And the Wanda Jean doc was, you know, this was, again, this was a lesbian woman on death row in Oklahoma who was going to be put to death for shooting her lover. And the question was, you know, in Oklahoma, clearly a jury could not find their way into any shared humanity with this woman. Could I? You know, the people who get sentenced to death in this country, such a small percentage of murderers, right? Of course, some huge terror act of terrorism. Okay, we see it. But just a murder, you know, there are a lot of murders and there are a lot of people who don't get the death penalty. Right. Why do some? Well, it has to do with dehumanizing them, right? And it's like in Oklahoma, that was a Black lesbian who, you know, was sentenced to death for a crime that is, as far as murders go, the most basic. You shoot your lover in a fight. Like, that's kind of what happens a lot with murders, unfortunately. Yeah. So it was looking for that shared humanity there. And I also worked a lot with Sheila Nevins, who ran HBO. And I know that that was something she wanted to do. She wanted to find a woman on death row. And Sheila Nevins, who ran documentaries there and is a real hero of mine.
She's a hero of documentaries.
Yeah. Yeah. And she was a mentor of mine. I mean, she really taught me so much. Yeah.
Like what?
Okay, there are a few things she said to me. The Wanda Jean film was the first film I made with her, and I was stressing out about a rough cut that I had sent her that was about 2 some hours long. And I said, oh, but it's just too long. It's too long. And I said, well, how long do you want it to be, Sheila? And she said, well, it should be as long as it is good. And you know what? That's true. It shouldn't be longer than it is good. And I have, like, you know, it sounds very simple, but in fact, you need to rigorously evaluate your work. You shouldn't make it long because you think you're so freaking interesting and you want to look at your navel. You have to make sure that it's the right length for it being good and good for your audience.
Right.
Other things, you know, she taught me was just to be fearless, you know, put the end of the movie at the beginning, you know, see what happens, you know, all those things that you learn as you grow as a filmmaker that in the beginning you're like, what? you know, I did all those things. I learned those lessons with her and she gave me the freedom. You know, many executives will just give you notes at 3:20, please trim, you know, blah, blah, blah. She talked to me about big picture ideas. Try it. Try throwing that there or try losing that person. And, you know, what will happen? You know, she really, you know, she was in the sauce with me. She was, you know, and it just gave me a lot of freedom and a lot of confidence.
And she, I mean, it seems to me that if anyone deserves credit for the elevation of documentaries to the degree that they are now and to the expanse that they are now, it's her.
I totally agree with you. I mean, she is the high, I said Nina Simone was the high priestess of soul. Sheila Nevins is the high priestess of documentary.
Because like HBO, like she had her own, like she ran that thing like almost outside of HBO proper. Like this was her thing, her empire, and in a way, and she gave opportunities to all these different documentarians.
She figured out two things: how to get ratings for her documentaries and how to get awards for them. And those two things kept her alive. And, you know, and you couldn't, you needed both, you know?
Yeah. Where's she now?
Well, she left HBO and she is running her own strand of documentaries at MTV, of all places.
Really?
Yeah.
MTV. Do you guys talk?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Oh. It was her birthday. We spoke recently. Yes. Yes. She's a real mentor of mine.
Now, let me, not to distract from our conversation, I'm curious as to the conversations that you're having now with your father, who's, 85, you know, around, like, you know, obviously we talked at the beginning and that, you know, the thoughts about, you know, what is important now in terms of conversations is how do we protect democracy. Now, what conversations where's he at with this shit right now?
That's a really good question. And one of the things he's talking about, which is, you know, kind of sad, is, you know, his free speech stance, which is that all the bad shit, you know, he worked on protecting the Nazis' right to march, right, in Skokie, Illinois, you know, a big ACLU case.
Right.
And now we see speech on the internet and, you know, the whole idea around fake news and the kind of trolling. And he questions his free speech stance in the era, wow, in the era of online propaganda and fake news. I mean, what was the story this morning about, you know, propaganda, outward state propaganda coming in towards fomenting the protesters who are walking around like idiots without masks and having the goddamn nurses come out of their job to stand up for themselves and say, stop making my job harder, you idiots, you know. That all of that conflict is being fomented by bad actors. And, you know, when you have the internet and you have Twitter and you have this, how do you protect truth?
Well, that's the thing I once said about Twitter. It's like, maybe it was better when everyone didn't have a voice.
How do you protect truth? How do you do it?
Right.
And, you know, and free speech does not do that.
Right.
Free speech says the good and the bad comes in. It allowed for Lenny Bruce. It allowed for an orderly march of the Nazi party. But in the age of the internet, it's a whole different thing.
That's right. Now, because they're protected, they've untethered truth from any sort of precedent or barometer of what it is. So
yes.
Now that you have people who can live in information bubbles almost on another planet, they can question anyone else's truth with, you know, what's your source? Who knows if that's true? And that's the end of it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think about what is being taught in schools. Like, we need to teach. And I know I see this with my children a little bit about, you know, sourcing. Like, if you read something, I remember during the 2016 election, my daughter came to me and she was looking at Instagram and she said, oh, do you know that Hillary Clinton is dying from a brain tumor? She has a brain tumor. And I was like, so where did you? And I just saw how, like, you know, on Instagram, which, you know, I would have just skipped over it because I could have told from the source that it was, you know, a right wing source or whatever it was. But it was right there in my daughter's Instagram feed. How did, you know,
yeah,
how do we litigate that? And I don't think my father has the answers, but he's having those questions.
But,
you know,
but the problem with litigation, too, on this level is that, you know, this is an administration that is completely engaged in constant litigation. You know, over anything, you know, for the specific reason to extend a time frame to, you know, to kind of bankrupt his enemies. I mean, that's his way of doing things. And that, and I don't know how your father approaches, you know, the use of litigation in that way to exhaust funds and resources of victims. But I mean, that's another issue between the truth being, you know, nebulous and under attack, is that you have over litigation used as a weapon, which has always been there. But, you know, now it just seems to be happening on every level. Are you re-engaging with him as a subject? Do you think you should do that?
I think you should have him on the podcast.
I would.
But I don't know the answer. I mean, it's like, no, I'm not re-engaging with him as a subject at the moment, but I'm engaging with him as an intellectual, you know, someone I learned from, an intellectual mentor, and it's interesting. And, you know, sometimes these private companies, you know, have seen, like with Facebook, seen the social pressures that have forced them to do some self-policing, but it's negligible, right, given how much gets out there.
But they don't give a fuck about the truth. That's the weird thing, is that, you know, you've got this audience of shallow people who, like, I have a personal trainer person, a woman who's relatively intelligent, who a couple of weeks ago said, did you hear, I read that Bill Gates might have caused the coronavirus. And it's like, what are you talking about?
Right. Right. I mean, like, right. I've had the same experience with somebody. I was just like, wait, really? Like, oh, you believe that? Like, whoa.
They're fucking with. See, once you, like, untether the truth, you're dealing with people's, you know, need to believe.
Right.
So, you know, and if something seems has closure or honors their feelings about whatever, they'll fucking just put it in there.
And it's actually much more comfortable to think, oh, Bill Gates started the coronavirus or China did this as an attack, than to just think, oh, God, the world works in really shitty ways. And I'm not sure how we're going to pull out of it. You know, easier narrative.
Sure, of course. It's clearly an environmental catastrophe, and it's a collapse of
healthcare
government. There's
yeah.
a million different things. All right. Well, we don't need to go crazy, but I'm very I'm disheartened but encouraged by the fact that you and your father are having conversations, and that because when I was watching your doc Shouting Fire, that it dawned on me, like, how does this apply to now, where the freedom of speech is completely not only in action, but malignant.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's right. And that doc was, what, 10 years ago? I mean, that was the beginning of WikiLeaks. Like, I remember those were just the beginning of the questions. Right. And we're in a whole different universe. And you're right, it should be updated. It should be updated. You know, and then I think about civil rights leaders. Martin Luther King said, "The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice." Really? Where is it? You know, and it's like, what are all these things that we believe from the 60s, the 70s, you know, like all of these things.
The bending, that curve has been flattened.
We've flattened
no
that
justice.
Curve, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I think that what I notice more, and even in moments where, you know, you see people, like, obviously the protests around these right-wing protests are you know, misled people by political forces.
And being financed, right, by right-wing.
Right, they're presented as theatrical events, but they don't know that. They think that, you know, somebody is, you know, they just watch your Facebook post and like, oh, this guy Jed is going to start a thing. We got to go to the thing. So they don't realize that it's a bunch of conservative think tank money or whatever it is. But what I think what's missing is this. And this is the fear of what's happening now, too, with just quarantine, and not in a governmental or abuse of power way on the government level, but this lack of tangible connection between people, that, you know, people are so isolated in everything they're taking in and how they're taking it in. They're almost, you know, more lonely with the information they have than before, that the conversation among people in face to face in real time, touching, holding, feeling common. What were you talking about? The common humanity or the shared humanity is collapsing. So, you know, when you have like legislators who are able to say there are more important things than living as a defense to open up a state's economy, you know, you realize, like, well, that's sort of craven, but it's really honest about that this country is based on capitalism, and many of these people, one way or the other, though they've been hiding it, have sought to maintain the survival of capitalism no matter what over anything. That's understandable. But the fact that he believes that people will be like, that guy's right, means that there's an incredible lack of connection between humans, right?
You know, it sure feels that way. And it I think it has so much to
sorry,
do.
I don't know why.
But I'll say, I mean, just to circle back once again, I mean, I think it has so much to do with who's elected. I mean, think about Georgia, right? Stacey Abrams might have been the governor of Georgia, right? But because of and we're seeing Brian Kemp right now saying, you know, you can safely open a tattoo parlor. How do you give a tattoo? First of all, okay, so it's the failure of the state to protect people during this downturn, right? Like, you know, I don't expect the tattoo artist to starve and die. I expect him to be able to rely on the state that he's been paying taxes to all his goddamn life to help him through, right? That's what I expect, and to keep him safe. But, and you know, and of course you can't socially distance with a tattoo parlor, and there's going to be terrible effects. But I go back to democracy, and I go back to the fact that right now it says sort of like 60 some percent of the people want social distancing to last longer so they can be safe and they don't have to have their grandpa die, or their friend who has bad asthma. But our elections have been gerrymandered and suppressed to the fact, to the point that we have Brian Kemp who's making these crazy things that does not reflect his people, because he only needs certain people to win. You know, because you only need certain voters.
That's right. It's a hell of a gamble they're all making. And, you know, this is the fucked up thing about having such craven leadership without any national agenda around, you know, kind of, you know, helping us understand what's happening and how to take care of ourselves, is that, you know, now we got to sit here and watch these states who are willing to roll the dice with the lives of their people, how that pans out. There's like, okay, here are the canaries in the coal mine of capitalism. If the economy is going to survive, we'll see how this goes. you know, it's a tough lesson to have to sit and watch. That we literally, right, as people, like my state happens to be a good state and they're doing everything they can and we have a decent leader. But now we're like, well, what's going to happen with this? And, you know, what about those poor people who are being used as sort of the stakes of this thing, you know, this gamble?
Yeah,
it's fucking nuts.
Right. Why is the conversation not about how do we protect our elderly and their nursing homes? Why are we not having, and how do we create jobs to do so? You know, how do we create safe jobs? What's the Manhattan Project to, you know, getting safe tracking? You know, that's the creative conversation.
Right. But we have a fucking president that hired a bunch of morons so he didn't feel outgunned. And now nobody knows how to do anything. And anybody who shows up who knows how to do something, he's threatened. And okay. We'll make that documentary later.
On it.
Did you ever do Air America? My producer Brendan seems to think you were around when we were around. Did you ever do interviews on Air America back in the day?
No, I think we hit you guys up a lot for different things.
Oh.
And now I can't remember what it was.
Maybe the Abu Ghraib thing, but that was later. Yeah. We were already kind of washed up by then. Maybe I was. Maybe it was still running. That might have been it. So now the Nina Simone documentary I thought was amazing because I didn't know a lot about her. I honestly knew nothing about her. And because of that, you know, I have this new, you know, beautiful creative force that I can appreciate in my life. But what compelled you to do that?
Well, and that's the best reaction that I hear, because I think now, you know, people knew Nina and they listened a little to Nina, or their friends put on Nina, or they put on Nina. But now you get this whole like 3D experience of like knowing her and knowing her values and knowing her sacrifices, and you bring it all to the table and you have this like such an intense experience of listening to her. That's like was my hope for that doc.
The depth.
What is behind this voice?
Yeah.
But that project, no, it came to me one of the weird, you know, sometimes things, you know, I got a call from somebody who said, you know, we have the rights to Nina Simone, you know, are you interested in directing this? And I said, I love her music. I don't know much about her life. Let me do a little reading. Let me see if I feel like there's a story there. Because at the end of the day, like we said, it's narrative. And, you know, you can be a great artist, but have a boring life. Not often, but sometimes. And, you know, lo and behold, that was not the problem here. You know, she had and we were making the film about Nina Simone at the moment of the birth of the Black Lives Matter protest. Like it was a really rich time to be digging into her personal history.
And what has been the response from, like, say if I can generalize in a non-exclusionary way, the Black community around that, what is the feedback? I mean,
feedback has been really, really positive. You know, I think I had Black producer, you know, we had a diverse team working on the film, and Nina's daughter, Lisa, was very involved in the film. So we had a lot of bona fides. You know, at the same moment that my film was being made, there was a Zoe Saldana film being made in which Zoe played Nina. And that, you know, made a lot of people understandably angry, because the darkness of Nina's skin, her, you know, the blackness of her skin was very much a hurdle in her commercial aspirations and her feelings about herself, and so it felt very wrong to people in the family to have Zoe, a very light-skinned, classically beautiful in the white sense woman, be playing Nina Simone. You know, I think that times have changed even since I made that doc, which wasn't that long ago. You know, if someone asked me now to direct the film, I might think differently about it. I might think that I should have a Black filmmaking partner making the film with me. I mean, I did have a Black producer, but even director. But at the end of the day, I think my team did, you know, check me and check my whiteness whenever it needed to be. And I haven't had that criticism from the film. Now people are going to come listen to your podcast and I'm going to get hate and they'll give me the criticism and I'll listen. but at the time that it came out and I'm still getting feedback from people very positively about the film.
So The Lost Girls, now, after a lifetime, it seems, though you're not that old, but I mean, I'm doing documentary.
Thank you.
A lifetime of doing documentaries. Why, you know, I mean, not that it's not worthy of it, but why this story? How do you make that shift? Because it's shot beautifully, the story's beautiful, but why this story and how did it evolve? Because it seems like it would have been a good documentary subject.
You know, I think there's a lot of answers to that. I have always been interested in narrative filmmaking. As I told you, when I studied film, I was doing that too. I went down a path of making documentaries incredibly happily. I love making documentaries. I'm making more documentaries. But, you know, it's harder for the lady filmmakers to get the scripted film budgets, right? I mean, Of course, that's changed over time. You said you're going out with Lynn Shelton. I don't know her evolution. But I kept on getting offered a lot more documentaries. I had some scripted projects I was working on, and that was, it was a different battle. And people talk about how great is it that documentary has so many female directors. I'm like, well, it's a bit of a, you know, double-edged sword because it's lower paid, right? And the budgets are smaller. So yeah, there are lots of women. What is it actually telling us? But this film, you know, the script came to me. As I said, I've been interested in a bunch of narrative projects. This film came to me. There had been documentaries on this, Mark, so I didn't feel that I right. needed to make a documentary. Right. What I felt was that the story of Mary Gilbert, you know, this ass-kicking, you know, Sally Field / Karen Silkwood / Erin Brockovich heroine was a story I loved. You know, I love ass-kicking strong women. You know, she came from a world that would never have guessed she would be able to raise her voice and have it listened to in the way that she did. And, you know, and the story of her raising her children, that's really the backstory of mental illness in her family, the sacrifices she had to make as a single mother. You know, those were things that you could dramatize through the scripted form with great actors that were unavailable as a documentary filmmaker. They were way in the past. Could you have talking heads talk about it? Sure. But would you see it and feel it differently with a couple great actors? Yeah. So for me, that was that was why I got behind this story. And it was the, you know, the rock that we were able to get to the top of the hill to get made.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, those the actors like were amazing. You know, Amy, Ryan, and the older daughter, the middle daughter.
Thomas and McKenzie is a huge talent. Yeah.
What the fuck, man? I mean, yeah. Like, you know, like not even talking. And I'm like choked up. I'm like, what's happening?
Forget it. I know. Shooting. I mean, it was all of us. We were just like, I mean, you know, you might have seen her in Leave No Trace. And then she was in Jojo Rabbit. She's a phenomenally talented actress. We're going to be seeing a lot of her.
But it was like, to me, well, it's interesting the way you frame the sort of like female heroine, you know, in comparison to like Erin Brockovich or Sally Field in, what is it, Norma Rae. But like, it's interesting because the scale of this is so different. I guess not so much than Silkwood, but like, because you really, like, I found myself, you know, through a good third of the movie, you know, not really liking Amy Adams' character and questioning, you know, her attitude around the reality. Because, you know, initially you feel like, is she in denial? I mean, does she not take, you know, it's a very complicated character that somehow or another, you know, you really are kind of wondering about until it breaks, you know, until she, you know, somehow the truth is revealed of her struggle, that she's not just doing this out of shame, right? You know, or anger at herself, but you know, she was, you know, the best mother she could be.
You know, I think that part of the evolution of female roles is allowing women, female characters, to lead movies who aren't immediately likable, you know?
For sure,
And I think that, you know, I really chafed at some of the, you know, notes you might get when you're making your film, making her likable, or, you know, it was just not, you know, how are you supposed to be fucking likable if you're raising three kids on no money, four kids, no mental health care.
Right.
You have a bipolar daughter. You have somebody who's doing calls, you know, work, you know, doing sex work while putting herself through college, who then goes missing and nobody gives a shit. Like, why are you supposed to be likable? You know, come on. That's not the story. I'm not saying it to you, but I'm just saying that's what I'm, you know, that's what I was working on, you know, and then it comes back to the shared humanity thing. Cause then by the end, you're like, I hope you're like, I get her, you know, I get it.
Of course.
And that was why I loved it, you know, and you're right. I don't know if Norma Rae or Karen Silkwood had those likability issues. It was a different moment, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't even so much likability. I mean, I certainly like a flawed character and a character that I, you know, I have to kind of really reckon with. And I think she's a great actress. But I think exactly the feelings I was having, you know, reflect my own judgment. So, like, it almost does, in a sense, you know, what a documentary would do. Like, I found myself... The weird thing was, to be honest with you, as a man, you know, when she refused to accept that her daughter, you know, could possibly have done drugs, you know, I sided with the other, you know, drug-addled prostitute. I was like, you know, I can't, you know, I literally said, you know, like, I can't take characters that aggressively are in denial. And it turns out that she probably wasn't a drug user. Right. So,
right.
So like there was that moment where I prejudged based on, you know, the characterization of these type of women and also being someone in recovery who was mad at her in that moment for not, you know, accepting that it's possible that her daughter had a drug problem. It really wasn't. And it wasn't even a hinge to the story. But it was like one of these things where I'm like, what a stubborn bitch that woman is, you know, like.
Yeah. And I think she would agree. She was a stubborn something. But I think that also it's like it just goes to the irrelevance of what I think the fact that people were trying to make it relevant to Shannon's disappearance, whether or not she was on drugs.
Right.
The woman is gone. She's running down the street in the middle of the night saying, help me.
Right.
This isn't about whether or not she used coke in calls. Like it's irrelevant. So I think that kind of once you understand that you're in that position, you're like, of course, it's going to make you mad or just, you know. So I think that it's like it's just the fact that it's brought up to dehumanize Shannon to make her worthless.
I think that's right. I think, but I also think that speaks to what we were talking about earlier is that, you know, all of this kind of like rabid politicizing and this sort of like the kind of malignant fake news trip, it's all dehumanizing. You know, because in a sense, I'm not saying it's the same, but this, like, for me to kind of buy into that, to like, you know, to diminish the fact that we lost a human being here is something that is incredibly relevant to the way they're discussing this virus and the way that we have a president who's unwilling to even address the number of dead, you know, with any empathy. That there's a dehumanization, you know, not let alone how immigrants are treated. It's something that we're being trained to do, which is, you know, speaks to what you're thinking about the future and how, you know, totalitarianism sinks in is through.
Well, yeah. It's like, if you heard, they say 50 people were dead in this nursing home near my house in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn. And what if you split that and you said, oh, 50 people dead at a, you know, at a high school, like, or an elite high school, you know, what would that
We're on a bus.
Like it's just right. Like it's like somehow the fact that they're in a. It's really if young people were bearing the brunt of this, I'm not wishing that, but I'm just saying the discourse might be very different from the top, right?
Yeah, but I also think that because it's a health issue that everybody's like, you know, in denial, like, you know, denial of one's mortality is like, you know, front and center in everybody's kind of unconscious thing. Like nobody wants to think about that. And the idea that you can be out in the world and get something that's going to kill you, people do not want to think about it.
Right. Right. Hence not wearing a mask. You know, it's
immature.
Crazy,
it's childish. But back to the movie, I thought it was beautifully acted, beautifully shot. And, you know, and it was, and now that you're telling me, you know, how you were thinking about it in terms of representation of women and victims and you know, our prejudgment of people. It's provocative. It's great. Good job.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, sure. So now what are you spending your days doing? Are you guys working, you and your husband? What's up?
We are working. I mean, the beautiful thing is that you know, you can edit, as you know, from, you know, a closet. Like, and so we were a little bit ahead of the curve and we're able to set up all these remote edit stations. And I have a series that's finishing on HBO. Are you friendly with Patton Oswalt?
Yeah, yeah. Him and I go way back.
We are doing a series for HBO based on I'll Be Gone in the Dark, his former wife, who's now deceased, book. So I've been really busy finishing that series.
Oh, great.
It's been great to be able to work through this period.
Oh, great.
I'm really busy.
And let me ask you another weird question, because I've been sort of mildly obsessed with. Do you remember when you started using the word storytelling, and when and when storytellers and storytelling, it just seemed to come on the scene, you know, like all at once, like the word authenticity, you know, like there are these sort of buzzwords, like, you know, I can see how it sort of replaced narrative, but like it's a relatively new idea to kind of start to use the word, because actors use it all the time now too. It's like, well, I see myself as a storyteller. I'm like, did you always though? You know, like, when did that happen? Where did storytelling come from?
It's such a good point. And my brain is flashing, if you're obsessed with it, my brain is flashing to some emails I got at some point or another from the Sundance Institute talking about storytelling labs.
Okay.
I wonder if there's a genesis in the Utah area from that. I don't know. I'm just making that up, but that's the first thing I thought of. I don't know.
But there's, right, that might be it, but also the moth and the storytelling shows.
Yes.
Like there was something, you know, that this, like it was a mode of expression in a one, like a replacing stand-up almost in some respect, that the storytelling performance series started, that kind of integrated as well.
Right. No, I think that's interesting. When do you think it started? Like 5, 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's fairly recent, because I'm annoyed by it. I'm not annoyed by you, but like, you know, it's like I'm annoyed by it in the same way that I'm annoyed by, you know, authenticity and artisanal.
Yeah. People started saying on the bubble a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. That's another
I don't know
one.
What that means.
Doubling down. Like was,
doubling
was
down.
Big. That was big. Yeah. Trump really did that.
Yeah.
The journalists really kind of pushed through doubling down with this presidency. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. I don't know. So I won't, I'm a filmmaker. I'm not a storyteller.
No,
I won't
mind.
Tell any stories.
You can tell stories. I'm just was curious if you realized that it was a newer word for you.
By the campfire.
Oh yeah, exactly. It was great talking to you. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for your service as a storyteller.
When do we start the interview?
Oh, that's right. We're going to start right now. And I'm glad that everybody's healthy there.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That was Liz Garbus. The film, again, is Lost Girls, which is streaming on Netflix. She's also the director of many documentaries, including What Happened, Miss Simone, and The Fourth Estate. And also, don't forget, however you reach out, try to make it clear to the desperate, angry, vulnerable people that things are not good and there's still sickness out there, like all over the place. Okay? We can't get clouded by desperation or desire for things to be okay. Okay? All right? All right? Keep your information clean, man. Okay. Boomer lives.